From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the Guantanamo Bay inmates trying to sue the US government to end force feeding at the detention centre.
I'm Alice Olstein, and I'll have a full report on the inmates' day in federal court coming up.
Also today, authorities in India arrest the crew of a US-owned ship laden with weapons. We talk to the private security company involved. Saudi Arabia sends its regrets. It won't take up a seat on the UN Security Council. A French court hands supporters of same-sex marriage a major legal victory. And Amnesty International fighting to save an Iranian from being executed twice.
It's bad enough that he had to go through this horrible experience once, but to have to go through it twice is just mind-boggling.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. President Obama has nominated former Pentagon official Jay Johnson to be America's next Director of Homeland Security. Mr. Johnson was a top legal official at the Defense Department during the president's first term and is viewed as one of the architects of the U.S. government's controversial national security policies. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Lorna Shaddock reports.
Jay Johnson has already been involved in a number of national security issues. As a General Counsel at the Department of Defense during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, he oversaw an increased use of unmanned drone strikes. He also revamped the use of military commissions to try terrorism suspects and was involved in the repeal of the military's ban on openly gay service members. He also mapped out the legal defense for the raid in Pakistan that killed Osama bin Laden. Lorna Shaddock, Washington.
The State Department says the United States has no plans to ease sanctions against Iran. The New York Times claimed on Friday that the Obama administration is mulling the move. FSN's Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff.
Earlier, a White House spokesman said Iran would have to agree to meaningful, transparent, and verifiable actions before the Obama administration could seriously consider taking steps to ease sanctions, and that it is premature and speculative to discuss types of sanctions relief. The New York Times reported, following detailed, straightforward, and candid conversations in Geneva, Washington was considering releasing the freeze on Iranian assets, giving Tehran access to much-needed cash.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he has not received any formal notification from the government of Saudi Arabia that it plans to decline a seat on the UN Security Council. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said on Friday it was turning down a chance to occupy a non-permanent seat, arguing the UN has failed in its international duties. Indian authorities have detained the crew of a US-owned ship on charges of illegally ferrying weapons and ammunition in Indian waters. In an early morning operation, all 35 crew members aboard the MV Seaman Guard Ohio were officially charged by police off the coast of Tamil Nadu. France's highest court has ruled that mayors in the country are legally obliged to marry same-sex couples. From FSN's Europe desk in Brussels, Sandra Gutman reports.
France's Constitutional Council has dismissed a legal challenge from a group of mayors arguing that a same-sex marriage law approved last May goes against the French Constitution because it failed to include a freedom of conscience clause. The mayors want a right to refuse to marry a same-sex couple if it goes against their religious or moral beliefs. The council rejected that argument on Friday morning, saying that, in view of the functions of a state official in the officiating of a marriage, the legislation does not violate their freedom of conscience. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Employees of the BART, San Francisco's main rail network, have gone on strike for the second time in 4 months. The labor action, which comes after talks on salaries and benefits broke down, is forcing thousands of commuters to find alternative ways to get around. From FSN's bureau in San Francisco, Rebecca Bowring reports.
After a week of will they, won't they, workers from the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, or BART, walked off the job at midnight on Thursday. Negotiators had been desperately trying to resolve disagreements between unions and management, but after 28 straight hours of talks, they failed to reach a deal. The sticking point? How to handle disputes over work rules. The parties have made progress on wages, pensions and healthcare during wranglings that have dragged on for 6 months. BART carries about 400,000 passengers each day. Many commuters got up early to try to board extra but insufficient buses and ferries. By 7 a.m, heavy congestion was reported on the Bay Bridge, with cars backed up for more than a mile. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
Pakistani education campaigner Malala Yousafzai has been meeting with Britain's Queen Elizabeth II at Buckingham Palace in London. From FSN's bureau in the British capital, Ollie Barrett reports.
At Buckingham Palace for a reception for Commonwealth, Youth and Education, Malala took the opportunity to hand the Queen a copy of her newly published memoir, I Am Malala.
And I want to represent you, my book, and...
That's really kind of you, thank you very much indeed.
And her campaign for girls' education continues, boosted by occasions such as this, which might be starting to feel run-of-the-mill for Malala Yousafzai.
There's more from us on Twitter. You can follow us there 24 hours a day at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today in a federal courtroom in Washington, D.C., where the future of force feedings at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center may be determined. Representatives of a group of detainees are arguing that the force feedings administered twice a day to hunger strikers at Gitmo violate the inmates' human and civil rights. But the government is urging the court to throw the case out. It argues the detainees have no legal right to question the steps the U.S. military takes to maintain order in the detention facility. FSN's Alice Olstein was at the court today and has this report.
A windowless courtroom at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals was packed Friday with lawyers, law students, and activists as Oakland-based attorney John Eisenberg argued on behalf of a group of Guantanamo Bay detainees whose multi-month hunger strike has been met with daily, non-consensual force feedings.
My belief is that force feeding is unethical. It's inhumane. It's a violation of international law and a violation of medical ethics.
But the case mostly focused on jurisdiction, as lower courts have ruled and the government continues to argue that the detainees have no legal standing as prisoners of war to question the force feedings or anything else. Justice Department lawyer Daniel Leonards told the judges that Congress passed laws with the clear intent of denying certain rights to the detainees and warned the court against allowing a new flood of legal challenges.
Were this court to rule that detainees at Guantanamo Bay are allowed to challenge the conditions of their confinement, it would create a new law, and it would allow numerous challenges that are currently prohibited by 2241E2 and by traditional notions of the scope of the writ of habeas corpus.
Senior Judge David Tatel countered that Congress also tried to deny the detainees habeas corpus rights, but that move was later ruled unconstitutional. Medea Benjamin, founder of the peace and human rights group Code Pink, who sat in on Friday's court hearing, said she thought the whole proceeding was an indictment of the U.S. justice system.
It's really horrendous that Guantanamo is this no man's land, not even within the jurisdiction of the courts, and that they're fighting just to get jurisdiction for this. And I think it sends a horrible message to the rest of the world that we can keep people on ships, we can keep them in black holes, we can keep them in places like Guantanamo, but God forbid other countries try to do that, and boy would we yell and scream about their human rights abuses.
Eisenberg told the three-judge panel Friday that normally the detainees would be barred from challenging these rules in court, but pointed to an exception in U.S. law that says if the conditions are, quote, so extreme as to transgress constitutional prohibitions, the detainees must be heard. He mentioned another way prison officials violated their rights by keeping them in solitary confinement during Ramadan, denying their right to practice communal prayer.
Close Guantanamo now! Close Guantanamo now!
Outside the courthouse, a group of activists gathered to demand the court grant the prisoners legal standing and demand President Obama use his authority as commander-in-chief to end the force feedings, as well as the indefinite detention that motivated the hunger strike. Andreas Contreras is an activist with Witness Against Torture, who's been fasting since July 8th in solidarity with both the prisoners in Guantanamo and those at maximum security prisons in California. He has voluntarily undergone, in public, the same force-feeding procedure as the detainees, with a tube inserted by a nurse through his nose and down his throat.
when the tube has gone in, at times it has blocked my capacity to breathe. It has felt like constant agony, and it is fire in your throat. And so I thought, there's no way I'm continuing. And then I thought of them who are tortured 2 times a day in this very way. And so I cannot stop, because we need to reveal to the light of day what is the torture that is happening in the shadows.
About half of the remaining 164 detainees have been cleared for release by all national security agencies of the U.S. government, but continue to be held indefinitely. The court is expected to issue a ruling on their legal rights in the next few months. In Washington, I'm Alice Holstein.
Now, as you cannot fail to have noticed if you've wandered past your local movie theatre lately, the new Tom Hanks movie, Captain Phillips, dramatises the real-life hijacking by Somali pirates of the US-flagged Maersk Alabama cargo ship back in 2009.
Listen up. We have been boarded by armed pirates. Stay hidden at all costs. No one any hostages.
We will follow the procedures to lock down, go dead in the water, and wait for help.
Stick together, and we'll be all right.
The pirate threat has spawned a large private security industry to protect commercial shipping. The size and sophistication of that industry has been thrown into the spotlight by the detention in India of a ship operated by the American maritime security firm Advan Fort. The company says the Seaman Guard Ohio is used as a support vessel by its armed guards involved in the anti-piracy effort off the Horn of Africa. FSN's Malcolm Brown spoke with company president William Watson.
Once inside the port, the Indian authorities sought to audit all of our firearms on board, and now have issues with that, although I believe all of our documentation is in order.
You make no attempt to conceal the fact that there are weapons on board. These were armed security. What, generally speaking, is the nature of the weapons that are carried on board?
The majority of the weapons are semi-automatic rifles that are routinely used for protection and against pirates and to dissuade pirates from coming aboard commercial vessels.
Obviously, the concern in India is likely to be that this in some way impinges on the sovereignty of the country. And are you worried about the kind of complications that could bring down on you?
Of course. I'm very concerned about our crew and about the guards who are there. These are all very brave people who are out there enduring hard conditions at sea and risky conditions when they're protecting vessels from pirates. And it's very concerning that they're now not able to carry out their duties, and their families are concerned at home that they're not able to return home to them quickly.
Obviously, you're very familiar with this world, but others may not be. But there is obviously a pretty substantial private security component now involved in the anti-piracy effort. How routine is this, and how many companies are using these kinds of services, and what's the nature of the job that your company does in this context?
Well, the vast majority of commercial vessels that transit through what is called the high-risk area now use private security on board their vessels. That's why there hasn't been a successful piracy attack against a commercial ship in over a year. It's because all of them have got guards on board. When Advan Fort first started some 4.5 years ago, there were only a handful of private maritime security companies. Now there are almost 200. So the field has definitely blossomed, and there are a lot of guards out there operating on a lot of ships.
And typically, what's the background and the training that these guards have?
Normally, in our case, all of our guards have at least 5 years exemplary military service. They're all honorably discharged. They're all well-trained as marksmen and in the care and handling of firearms. They all are also licensed seafarers. They all have advanced first aid training, and they've also been trained in what we call the customs and courtesies of the sea, so they understand and know how to work on board a commercial vessel.
Finally, what is the nature of your interactions with Indian officialdom, and what communication are you having with U.S. and other diplomats in an effort to resolve this situation?
Well, of course, we've reached out to the U.S. State Department and to the various foreign offices of the home countries of the various guards. We have people on the ground in India who are negotiating. We've retained counsel in India. We have our country manager in India, all of whom are working feverishly to try and get this situation resolved as quickly as possible and allow these men to return to their jobs. Because ironically, while they're in port, they're not protecting seafarers, and a very large percentage of the population of seafarers are Indian nationals. So it's actually Indians being put at risk by this.
FSN's Malcolm Brown talking to Advanfort President William Watson. Now, it's considered the most coveted spot at the UN, a seat at the Security Council. But that didn't stop Saudi Arabia from taking the unprecedented move of rejecting the offer. It thought the snub was over what Saudi leaders regard as the UN's failure over Middle East issues, chiefly Syria's civil war. This compounds recent criticism for the UNSC over its convoluted procedures and structure, sparking calls for reform. Our UN correspondent, Stephen Fee, has more.
Chad, Chile, Lithuania, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia are elected members of the Security Council for a two-year term beginning on 1 January 2014.
And with that, it seemed like a done deal. Five candidates for five spots on the Security Council. The requisite handshakes and polite applause followed Thursday's balloting. But hours later, the Saudi Foreign Ministry issued a statement blasting the Council's double standards, criticizing the 15-member body's decisions on Syria, Egypt, and the greater Middle East, and announcing it would not assume its seat.
Saudi Arabia, which was a founding member of the UN, has never been on the council. So that is quite unique.
That's Paul Romita, a research analyst at the publication Security Council Report. Saudi Arabia has been campaigning for an elected spot since 1998, making its withdrawal that much more peculiar.
Countries wait 10, 20 years before they're even running for the council. They'll announce their candidacies well in advance. So it's sort of a prize thing to get on the council.
A prize no more, at least to Riyadh. In their statement, Saudi Arabia said the council had failed to apply deterrent sanctions against the Syrian government, which the Saudis blame for a chemical weapons strike in August that killed hundreds. Saudi Arabia was expected to assume a spot normally granted to an Arab state, and Romita says the Saudis could have had influence on a region that's become a principal concern for the Security Council.
You have countries that hadn't been on the agenda, Yemen, Syria, Libya. There had been sanctions on Libya, but now in the past two or three years, it's coming on the agenda again.
The Saudis have shown increasing frustration with the UN lately. Their foreign minister canceled a scheduled speech to the UN General Assembly this fall. Canadian diplomat David Malone, now an undersecretary general and rector of UN University, says normally a Security Council seat is a gesture of affirmation in the UN.
It's an existential cry. It is us affirming that we exist. We have a right to be in the council every now and then because we exist.
But if being a council member is an assertion of existence, Saudi Arabia, at least for today, seems to be calling an absent. Stephen Fee at the United Nations, New York.
Next, tonight, an extraordinary story that's testing the character of Iran's judicial system. 9 days ago, a 37-year-old Iranian identified only as Alireza M was hanged in the northeast of the country after being convicted of possessing crystal meth. A doctor declared him dead and his body was taken to a mortuary where, the following morning, he was found still to be alive. Now he's being nursed back to health, but the judge in the case says he must be hanged again. FSN's Rebecca Foster spoke to Amnesty International's Elise Auerbach about the case.
He was declared dead by a medic at the scene. He was taken to a morgue, and a day later, while his body was getting ready to be delivered to his family for burial, it was discovered that he was still breathing. And so he has been sent to a hospital. And incredibly enough, the authorities have said that as soon as he is, quote-unquote, well again, he would be subjected to a second attempt to execute him. And we find this extraordinarily troubling. It's bad enough that he had to go through this horrible experience once, but to have to go through it twice is just mind-boggling.
So Iran has executed 508 people so far this year alone, and mostly for drug-related offenses, as you mentioned. And Iran has been taking some criticism for this. What would Amnesty International say that this high number says about the current status of Iran's justice system?
I should say that we are not certain exactly how many people have been executed so far this year. That's actually a conservative estimate, based on figures that have been provided by the media, Iranian media, and also other figures that we've been able to compile. So the actual number could be higher. And Iran has consistently executed more people per year than any other country except China. It's still one of the very small handful of countries that continues to execute juvenile offenders. And as you mentioned, most of the people who get executed in Iran are executed for drug offenses. And according to international law, people can only be executed for very serious crimes. The offenses for which many of these people are being executed for, drug trafficking, drug possession, and so forth, are not what would be considered crimes that would warrant execution under international law. We acknowledge the fact that Iran has a very serious drug addiction problem, and of course, this is a problem that needs to be addressed, but executing people is absolutely not the way to address this problem.
So in Amnesty International's opinion, what are some of the main criticisms of Iran's justice system, and are there steps that they could take to improve those things?
Sadly, Iran, there actually was a revision of Iran's penal code that was finalized earlier this year. And even though it was an extensive process, unfortunately, the new penal code maintains many of the problems of the earlier penal code in that so many offenses are subject to capital punishment. In addition to the fact that there are so many different types of offenses that are subject to execution in Iran, Iran's courts are also extremely unfair. A lot of these people are convicted in Iran's revolutionary courts, and we have found that they're inherently unfair. They regularly use confessions that are extracted under torture. Very often the defendants and their lawyers are not notified of the exact charges, nor are they able to view the evidence that's being used against them. And there are just so many problems with Iran's judicial system that make the application of the death penalty doubly unfair.
Elise Auerbach of Amnesty International talking to FSN's Rebecca Foster. In Paris today, supporters of gay marriage won an important legal victory. The country's highest court ruled that a group of local mayors must agree to perform same-sex marriage ceremonies in accordance with a new law passed by French President François Hollande. Earlier this year, there were large protests against the law across France. FSN's Simon Marks spoke today to Kate Moody, our correspondent in the French capital.
Well, mayors around the country started refusing to perform same-sex marriage ceremonies. Here in France, marriages must be performed by state officials, by a mayor or some other authority figure in town hall. And Jean-Michel Collot, who's the mayor of a town in southwest France, was the first to refuse to perform a same-sex marriage ceremony in June. That was just actually a few weeks after the legalization took effect. And more began to follow suit, saying that performing same-sex marriages went against their religious, moral, or personal beliefs. And their appeal finally made its way to the Constitutional Court.
And what happens next legally? Is the Constitutional Court in Paris where this ends?
Not by any means. What we've heard from the group of mayors today after this ruling is that they want to meet directly with President François Hollande. They want an explanation for this ruling. Now, whether that will help their case in a legal sense, we don't really know. But they've also said that they plan to go to the European Court of Human Rights. They think that it's their own personal rights that are being violated by being forced to perform these ceremonies, which do seem to go against their religious or personal beliefs. So the legal battle is not yet over, and nor, I have to say, is the battle of the people, if you'd like to put it that way. Manif pour tous, which is the group at the forefront of these anti-same-sex marriage protests and has been for months, this group is saying that it has about 80,000 signatures on a petition in support of this group of mayors. So I do think we're going to be seeing more of it.
So is it wrong to view these mayors as just a group of last holdouts battling against what François Hollande would argue is now settled French law?
I think it would be wrong to put it that way, yes. I think the anger and the energy that we saw of the protests earlier this spring has not died out at all. There's a lot of quite vehement and surprising, actually, opposition to these same-sex marriages here in France. I think François Hollande may not see any more political problems. So far, the courts seem to have backed same-sex marriage each time that it's been challenged there. But he is certainly, I think, going to see more problems on the streets, more people coming out and protesting. The anti-same-sex marriage protesters have vowed not to give up. They say this won't be the end of their fight. And polls suggest that still about half the French population remains against gay marriage.
FSN's Kate Moody in Paris. Now, US government scientists could lose decades worth of medical research on fighting global health epidemics because of deepening budget cuts and endless political turmoil and gridlock in Washington. The latest deadlock, which prompted a temporary US government shutdown, may be over for now, but scientists fear future crises could cost the US its lead in biomedical research. And as Nina Maria Potts reports, Africa could end up paying the price as well.
The doors of government may now be open, but the cost of keeping them shut will hurt for some time. The three-week shutdown stripped the US economy of an estimated $24 billion. But the health of millions of people worldwide was jeopardized as well.
The shutdown of the U.S. government's been very damaging in the area of HIV/AIDS, globally and also domestically.
Chris Collins is vice president and director of public policy at AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research. He says the forced closure of America's leading medical research center, the National Institutes of Health, crippled the work of government scientists.
New grants aren't being considered. Grants that are currently in the field aren't being considered for no-cost extensions. Peer review meetings are not happening to consider research of the future. Research is going to be absolutely central to getting ahead of the HIV epidemic, but it stopped in its tracks.
Global disease surveillance was also dealt a devastating blow. Ground that government researchers now back at their desks will have to somehow make up. But much longer-term budget cuts are costing lives in Africa and Asia, places where the U.S. has had an active role in combating global diseases like malaria and TB.
That has a real human impact in the field. It means that we can buy fewer antiretroviral therapies for people who are living with HIV. We can buy fewer insecticide-treated bed nets. We can treat fewer people for TB. We know how to save so many lives right now and how to prevent disease, HIV and other diseases. But we're not putting the effective tools in the field at the rate we could because of the downward pressure from sequestration and other budget decisions.
The purse strings have been tightening for some time. From 2003 to 2012, NIH lost 22% of its purchasing power. The sequester that kicked in March this year put a stop to 700 important research projects. Translate that from the laboratory to the field, and the US could lose its ability to end global health epidemics altogether, or even track them properly. Scientists say the political stalemate, deeper budget cuts, and fiscal crises that have come to define Washington's ability to function are also undermining its ability to fund and manage health and research programs. All of which is damaging America's global lead in biomedical research. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme. Our email address is reports@featurestory.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter @FeatureStory. Coming up on Monday, modern day condemnation of a 1960s cancer study in New York's Bowery. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.